Number nine, which is a briefing, quality deer management. And Dr. Jerry, I will turn it over to you, sir.
Thank you, Chair Smith. For the record, I'm Jerry Nelson. I'm the Deer and Elk Section Manager of the department. Good afternoon, Commissioners, Director.
At your June commission meeting, Commissioner Wecker requested that the agency provide a briefing on quality deer management, the pros and cons, and the basic philosophies that underlie. So we reached out to the CEO of the Quality Deer Management Association, Brian Murphy, and Mr. Murphy very generously accepted our invitation to come out and speak with the commission on his own dime, I might add. And so he's going to give us a briefing on all of the ins and outs and pros and cons of quality deer management. And with that, I'll turn it over to Brian.
Thank you, Jerry. And is my mic on? Can you hear me okay? Yeah, I'm a little closer. Chairman Smith and the commission, I greatly appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today. I'm running on fumes because by your time, I've been up since just after midnight to get here, but I'm glad to be here, and it's one of only five states I had not visited prior to coming here, so I got to check something off my bucket list here today. So I come here not to give recommendations. I was not asked to do so. I'm not qualified to do so. I have not worked in your state. I have managed whitetails in about 25 states and a couple of, and other species of deer in other countries, but I'm not here to do that. I'm here to paint a picture of quality deer management predominantly as it's being practiced in the eastern half of the United States, which is obviously the foothold of the whitetail, and maybe give you some insights as to some ideas that perhaps could be incorporated in other thinking and processes down the track. I thought I'd start fairly broad. I looked at some of your backgrounds, noticed that many of you have a solid fisheries background. You may or may not have a solid background in sort of a history of how we got to where we are today with deer in this country. So I've got just literally a couple of slides to get started with. How did we get where we are today? Most of you are aware of the dark days in this nation when we just about got rid of everything. Like I told you, I'm running on fumes. I can say that word. But due to market hunting and subsistence hunting and habitat destruction in particular, much of the whitetail population, much of our big game that we cherish today were wiped out across this great nation. And that was followed by a period of what we consider the restocking and recovery period. And your state is somewhat unique in that only a handful of states in this country used only in-state sources of its deer to restock its herd, at least in whitetail, from a whitetail perspective. So you are somewhat unique in that regard. Many states like Michigan, Wisconsin, Texas, for example, gave most eastern states the majority of their deer. So many of the states that we hunt in the east really are an amalgamation, a melting pot, if you will, of whitetail genetics from a number of different locales. Some of which still have repercussions today. We're still seeing in some areas that had large restocking efforts of a single source, we're still seeing some repercussions of that with increased susceptibility to EHD, for example, where some of our northern deer were brought into the south. We're seeing resistance to other things based on where those animals came from. That was followed, again, mostly in the east. I suspect it occurred here in the west. Once our herds were in that recovery period, female deer were largely protected. Bucks of any size were better than a doe of any account. And, in fact, I grew up in a hunting camp like many did in the east where it was sacrilegious to even discuss taking a doe. You could take a buck of any age, antlered buck, but not a doe. That period pretty much still exists in some nooks and crannies, but certainly was the norm during that 1940s to 1970s phase. And this is what brought about the early thinking of quality deer management. And a Texas wildlife biologist named Al Brothers and his colleague Murphy Ray Jr. back in the late 70s were managing some large ranches for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Service. And they started thinking that maybe there was a different way to manage deer, maybe a whole herd concept, maybe a habitat concept, not just take every buck you can and no females. So they collaborated on a book that really would set the course for the modern quality deer management movement. That book, Producing Quality Whitetails, published in 1975. By today's thinking, is nothing novel. We take for granted almost every word in it is happenstance. But I can tell you at the time, it was quite significant. That's Al Brothers there in both of those lower photos. He is still alive today and quite the pioneer. And the definition is very straightforward. It's not rocket science. It's about protecting some of those young bucks in the population, in particular 1.5 and 2.5-year-old bucks, as it's most practiced across the country, but certainly 1.5-year-old bucks, combined with an adequate harvest of female deer to keep that herd balanced from a sex ratio perspective and balanced from a density perspective so that you have a healthy herd and a healthy habitat. Again, this is nothing overly novel. But what happened also during this 1970s, 1980s period is we started to hit the inflection point with our national whitetail population. And literally from 1985 to the early 2005-2010 period, we saw a doubling of the whitetail herd in this country from roughly 15 to 30 plus million animals. And what we saw from that was an overpopulation in many areas, at least on a localized scale, very skewed sex ratios, very young buck age structures, habitat destruction. We saw a lot of the ill effects of overabundant deer herds. And these herds, as they began becoming more densely populated, again, mostly in the eastern half of the U.S., this graph shows the number of animals per square mile of habitat. The red exceeds 40 animals per square mile. Many of those herds would be in the 80 to 100-plus deer per square mile range to give you an idea of how densely populated some of these herds are, and in fact, in some cases still are. And that brought about a stage for a shift in the paradigm of traditional deer management to one of quality deer management. And that's where our organization came on the scene. Our founder, Joe Hamilton, was a veteran biologist with the South Carolina Wildlife Department. He had read the book from Al Brothers from the 70s, and it inspired him because he was managing at the time, roughly, he and a colleague, 1,800 hunting clubs in lower South Carolina. And I can tell you it was a very high deer density in those days. And at that time, he also visited a group in Australia that inspired him to create an organization based on ethics and what's right by the resource, putting the resource first. And so that was the combination, a Texas message with an Australian twang that brought our organization together in 1988. So Joe Hamilton started the Quality Deer Management Association. At that time, it was called the South Carolina Quality Deer Management Association. It was not intended to be a national organization when he founded it. And it was just a matter of time before that name had to change with our growing membership. And if you think of good American stories from the bootstraps up, this is one. If you look at the building behind Joe and his wife Donna, that served as our national headquarters for several years. And in fact, that still is the office that he works out of today. Our founder actually works for the organization still. We took it from that luxurious locale to the upstairs bedroom in a rental house that I had 19 years ago. So we have come from very humble beginnings, and our staff now numbers roughly 40 individuals, with about 7 of those being biologists. But back in the day, I was a staff of one, so I have a pretty long history. This is my 19th year with the organization. We are a 28-year-old 501c3 nonprofit organization. We have roughly 60,000. In fact, I checked yesterday, it was 61,000 and change members, all 50 states, Canada, and several countries. Like the other nonprofits in the species, the Critter Arena, Ducks Unlimited, Turkey Federation, we have chapters. We just simply call them branches. We actually had one in the state of Washington for a period of about 2 years. We do not have one now. They're volunteer-driven, so we don't have much of a footprint here in the East. Our national office is in Athens, Georgia. Why you say Athens, Georgia? That's where I did my master's degree, and when they offered me the job, I said, why not stay here? I had good relationships with the university, and for those that may not be aware, the University of Georgia is widely regarded as perhaps the preeminent whitetail research university in the country. So it was a good place to be. And also, a donor gave us $1 million gift of land, and that often dictates where you put a building is when you get free land. Our mission is fairly straightforward. It's to ensure the future of whitetail deer, wildlife habitat, and our hunting heritage. To many, it means better deer, better quality deer, however they define that, and better deer hunting opportunities. What perhaps distinguishes us from many of the nonprofits is the breadth and depth of biological and outreach materials that we offer. That's kind of the bread and butter that brought us to the dance. Our founder was a biologist. I'm a biologist. Many of our board members are biologists. We are, in essence, the liaison in many cases between the end user, the landowner, and the hunter, and the science that often gets published in obscure technical journals that are very difficult to read and interpret. So we take that information the best we can, repackage it in a slightly more popularized form, and get it out to the end user. And that's in all media forms. And I hope that many of you have gotten some of that information that I sent in advance to thumb through. We also do quite a bit on the outreach from an outreach perspective. Our REACH program, as we call it, it's an acronym for Research, Educate, Advocate, Certify, and Hunt, is our landmark mission in action. That program is now 10 years old. In that period, we funded over $500,000 in whitetail research projects in 22 states. We've hosted, in fact, now over 2,000 educational events, public educational events in 36 states and several Canadian provinces. We've engaged in well over 500 policy or management issues in 30 states and several provinces. In fact, we've engaged in over 100 just this year alone. So we are very busy when the legislatures are in session. A lot of things do impact deer. We offer also a very intensive deer certification training program, both for laymen and women, but also for biologists. And in fact, we've been contracted now by five state wildlife agencies to conduct very specific deer management workshops for their staff, and we have one planned for 2017 already. But we also offer an online and in-person program for individuals, a three-level certification program. We also have our hunt is our Hunting Heritage Outreach Arm, and that's a youth program and a new Share Your Hunt program that we're very excited about. Membership, as you can see, we started off as a good idea, and it took us a while to get some momentum in the late 90s. Then we took off like a rocket ship until the recession hit, and like many companies, followed a similar path that we got knocked on the head a little bit during that recession and have bounced back since then. What's going on across the country? What are some of the trends? That's who we are. What impact have we had, either individually or in concert with partners? We're seeing a new deer hunter on the landscape. Certainly, they're more knowledgeable about deer hunting and management than ever before, sometimes misinformed by the public, but certainly those that want to know good information can have access to that information, either through us or through universities and other outreach areas. More likely to embrace quality deer management, no question there. More engaged in land management. We're seeing landowners and hunters really working together on the landscape and improving habitat. And many of them start with the simple things, food plots or putting out some deer mineral. But we're seeing them shift to native warm season grasses, timber stand improvement. We're seeing them do some things that have long-term implications for conservation. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. And no question, they're more interested in the future than previous generations. We did a survey in 2013 through one of our corporate sponsors, Bass Pro Shops, and we asked them to select 1,000 customers that bought very specific types of deer management products from them within the past year, from 1,000 from each geographic region of the country, and we asked them a series of questions, but one was very simple. Do you follow the principles of quality deer management where you hunt? 82% indicated they did. Now, I recognize this is not a scientific survey. It's full of biases, but it just shows you that a substantial percentage of the American deer hunting public at least identifies themselves with practicing quality deer management, although we did not define what that specifically was in that questionnaire, in that survey. One encouraging trend that we see in the East, and this is particularly notable in states that have small average landholder size, and what I'm referring to there is places like Michigan, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, places where the average hunting block may be a 40 or an 80 or 160 acre tract. In fact, it's fun when you go to, and I do get the ability to travel around. You go to Texas, ranchers there will apologize for anything less than 5,000 acres. I just got a little tiny place, a little 4,500 acre place. If you go to Michigan, it's the guy wearing the suspenders in the back of the room because he's got a 320. And because it's all 40s and 80s, and it's kind of an interesting dynamic. But what we're seeing is these landowners and hunters working together across fence rows. And in fact, just last month, we embarked on a project in partnership with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and six participating states to look at the conservation benefits, not the deer benefits, the conservation benefits of landowners working together across property lines to look at scale for conservation and perhaps even the impact to reduce the number of species that may be listed one day under the Endangered Species Act. So we're looking at some pretty cool stuff that deer hunters are driving in this case. We're also seeing an increased willingness to harvest antlerless deer. That may not be true in some parts of your state, from what I gather. There may be a few holdouts in some regards. But from a history standpoint, 1999 was the first year on record that more antlerless deer were taken in this country, whitetails, than antlered bucks. That was a significant turning point, and one that we needed because our herds were growing out of control in many areas. And by 2005, nearly two-thirds of all states in the whitetails range were taking more antlerless deer on an annual basis. 2014 is also a very monumental year. It's the first year, at least again in the states that we have data for, where more 3.5-year-old bucks were harvested nationwide than 1.5-year-old bucks. That's a very significant trend, I can assure you. Many of the places in the eastern U.S., Pennsylvania, for example, prior to some of their antler restrictions that Dr. Gary Ault implemented, they were taking in excess of 85% to 90% of their harvest annually were 1.5 years of age. There were adult hunters older than myself that lived their entire hunting careers in the state of Pennsylvania and never saw a 2.5-year-old deer, never one. I mean, that's how efficient they were at cropping off their young bucks annually. So we're seeing this shift primarily being driven by the hunters. Certainly there is some regulatory control involved here. A handful of states have antler restrictions, but most of this change is coming from hunters voluntarily saying, we want a different outcome, a different experience than what we have historically had. And I think that's very encouraging. And again, just doing the math, this 29% reduction results in about 800,000 additional yearling bucks that at least make it through the hunting season, most of which are available as 2.5-year-old deer the following season. So we have seen a substantial shift in hunter attitudes and also buck age structures. Just some examples here to give you an idea of how well some of these states are doing from this perspective. If you look at the top graph or chart there, you know, Arkansas, with a low of only 8% of their harvest being 1.5-year-old bucks, that's pretty incredible. To the right of that, you see the states with the highest remaining percentage of yearling bucks in the harvest, and the bottom just shows you the 3.5 and older categories. Again, not too surprising that some of the southern states have the ability to have those older bucks, because they have lower hunter numbers. There's about 2.1 hunters, deer hunters, north of the Mason-Dixon for every one hunter south of the Mason-Dixon. Just sheer math will tell you that those northern states are trying to cater to a higher number of deer hunters, and so it becomes a resource allocation challenge. So if you look at quality deer management on the spectrum of management options, it kind of sits fairly well dead in the middle. If you look from the far left there, no management at all, to the over-the-top deer farming, the real intensive stuff, QDM sits somewhere toward the middle. Most people practice QDM from the upper stages of traditional management. If you don't know what I'm referring to there, traditional management really is take a buck of any size, any time, and relatively few does. As you shift towards the more intensive side of that scale, you protect more and more age classes of bucks, and typically you shoot more and more does as a rule, because you're trying to keep that herd down so that each individual animal has full nutritional opportunities. All right, what are some of the pros and cons of QDM? We'll go through the pros first. Obviously, connecting a deer hunter with the habitat and with their deer herd improves that balance between the deer and their habitat if it's implemented correctly. The hunter knowledge and engagement with deer management and habitat management also improve. Other wildlife benefit from anything you do, or nearly anything you can do for deer if you do it correctly. Those sex ratios in those deer herds, older bucks in the population. Again, if health was an issue, it often does result in improved deer herd health, body weight and antler weight gains, lactation rate increases, survival, etc. Improved opportunity to hunt these bucks. Many an increasing number of hunters want to use tactics like rattling and calling, and those are far more effective and enjoyable when you have adult bucks out there. Yearling bucks simply don't respond at the same level. And again, for a growing number of hunters, that is a satisfying experience. Some of the potential costs or downsides, for those that aren't looking for that type of experience, obviously it can reduce enjoyment for them, because it does often is accompanied with certain rules and restrictions. You can't take this, you got to take that. And to some people, that is not an enjoyable part of the hunt. Can create conflicts between hunters that are pro-QDM, if you will, and those that are against it. And that can be on a property-specific basis within a hunting group, or it can be across property lines, and I've seen both of those. It can be expensive and time-consuming, at least compared to traditional deer management. Can limit or prohibit access to some hunters. I've seen it also open access, so it can go both ways there. Some will end up being charged a higher property access fee for that experience. Many are more than willing to pay it. Many are looking for that next level of their hunting opportunity. Some are not. Can reduce or result in a redistribution of the buck harvest, and what I mean by that is in some cases the more successful hunters are more likely to harvest those older age class bucks than those novice hunters or those weekend hunters, and so it can change the distribution of the buck harvest. It can increase non-harvest mortality on these adult bucks. Obviously, if you're putting another age class or two into the winter, whether it be predation, EHD, winter mortality, then they're subject to other risk factors. And this is an important one, and I'll speak to our perspective on this. It certainly can reduce the success of new or first-time hunters. And this is always a big consideration, and we strongly encourage an exemption for young hunters. First-time hunters, they should be able to take any darn thing they want. My first deer was a button buck, and I'm proud of it. And we shouldn't restrict the harvest of those first-time hunters. There's enough animals out there in that population for the new hunters, the young hunters, perhaps even the aged hunters, and those with physical disabilities. Very strong supporters of that. All right, a couple of quick facts here about the East versus the West to give you some perspective. About 85% of whitetail hunting in the eastern half of the United States occurs on private lands. And in the world I live in, public land deer hunting is almost unheard of. It just does. I mean, certainly it takes place, don't get me wrong, but it's the polar opposite of what you deal with out here. In fact, in many of the states, as you'll see, you know, look at some of these percentages of private land in some of these states. Kansas, Alabama, Iowa, Nebraska, Texas, 97% or greater private land. You know, the key to conservation, the key to hunting in the eastern U.S. is private lands and innovative access programs that allow public use. And we have not been as effective or successful at opening those private lands that some of the eastern western states, and in fact Washington included. There are a lot of good examples from the West that we need to replicate in the East. That said, there are some states with reasonable footprints of public land. If you look at Wisconsin and Florida and Michigan, for example, you know, 5 to 9 million acres of public land, and in some cases 14 to 20% of those states in public land that's open to deer hunting. So it's not all lost in the East. But certainly it's a challenge compared to what you enjoy here. Good news, we surveyed state agencies last year, 2015, and found that over the past 10-year period, that a majority of eastern states have actually increased their holdings of land for public use, which I thought was very encouraging. We didn't know what we'd find when we surveyed the states, but we're encouraged to see that. None, in fact, had lost acreage over a decade period, which I thought, again, was very positive. All right, quality deer management, as we advocate it, really, it's like building a house. You need a strong foundation. It's not a one-trick pony. It's not an antler restriction. That's not quality management. It's not shooting does. It's not food plots. It's about focusing on all four aspects of what makes a successful deer program. And that's true whether it's mule deer or the fallow deer and things I worked with in Australia and New Zealand. It's the same there. Quality management works on any of those species. You have to adjust it to fit the biology of the animal, but the principles are very straightforward. Managing the herd, managing the habitat, managing the hunters, and in particular hunter expectations. That's the biggest challenge there. And herd monitoring. And that's the tricky one also. It's getting hunters and or state agencies, depending on the case, to collect the right data so that you can assess where you've come from and where you're going and if you're being successful with your objectives. So I'll start briefly just on the herd management side. Most hunters immediately gravitate towards what are we going to do to protect these bucks. They're less, generally speaking, less concerned about the doe side of things. And there are a myriad of ways you can protect young bucks from harvest, and there's no perfect one, I can tell you. There's downside to every one of them. The most common ones are the ones I show here, but there are others. The ones above the line that I've drawn are those most often used by state agencies to achieve these objectives. Those below that are ones that we often see at the private lands interface. go through a couple of these real quickly. Antler point restrictions. I know you have had some antler restrictions, and I think it was Region 1, and may still have some in some other regions. I'm not sure. There's obviously a lot of controversy around antler point restrictions. There's some good. There's some bad. There's some indifferent associated with them. Our position on APRs is very straightforward. It must pass a very simple three-point litmus test. Is the APR biologically correct? In other words, does it protect a majority of year-and-a-half-old bucks? This is how they're applied in the East anyway. A majority of one-and-a-half-year-old bucks, around 80%, without protecting a significant proportion of two-and-a-half and older. We want those bucks to be available for harvest. Second one, does a majority of the affected hunting and landowner public support it? Do they want it? Because if they don't want it, it will not succeed in most cases. And third, and equally important, is there an objective monitoring program in place, a data collection and monitoring program that can objectively assess whether it's a meeting its stated intent or not? Because if it's not, we'd be the first one to suggest it be removed. We have supported some and we have opposed some historically, our organization. Antler point restrictions, they're great. I just want to go back a slide here just to bring a point home. All of those antlers in that circle are from the same age class of buck, a one-and-a-half-year-old buck age class. Antler point restrictions would focus the harvest on those three or four on the far right, the largest ones. And over time, that causes me some concern from a high-grading perspective because it protects that entire two-thirds of those smaller antlered year-and-a-half-old bucks and makes your best antlered yearling bucks available for harvest. That does not make sense from a long-term perspective. All right. Advantages of it, it's pretty simple. Even in Arkansas, they can typically count to four on a side. So that from a law enforcement perspective, it typically is one that law enforcement can deal with. It's easy to enforce. But unfortunately, it's not a good one from a biological perspective. In most situations, there are some examples. In high-quality habitats, let's pick Iowa, for example, they would be a train wreck because a majority of over 50% in many sites of year-and-a-half-old bucks produce four or more antler points at 1.5 years of age. So you're not really protecting a significant portion. It's difficult sometimes to protect enough of those yearlings and without protecting a disproportionate number of those older animals. And, again, you may unintentionally focus pressure on some of those superior antlered yearling bucks. A number of states still use them, and that number is growing. Antler point restrictions in general are popular with hunters because after they've hunted under them a couple of seasons, they are very loath to get rid of them because they do like seeing those larger antlered bucks because they do, generally speaking, put more bucks in the older age classes, which is their intent. Again, not without baggage, but certainly they have achieved their objective in many cases. So we see a large number of states with antler restrictions now for whitetails, either statewide, parts of state, maybe on one buck tag, maybe on all buck tags. I mean, there's a whole lot of combinations here, but there are some degree. Three states also use antler spreads in various ways, Texas, Mississippi, and Georgia. That I'm aware of, the three that still use an antler spread restriction in some way. They are better than antler point restrictions. They're biologically better than the antler point restrictions. But they're a little bit more difficult for hunters, the average hunter, to judge in the wild and more difficult to enforce somewhat. And there are some deer like this one here, fully mature whitetail with a 14-inch outside spread. And in many of these states, this buck would not have been eligible for harvest. So, again, some baggage there. Bag limits and draws, quotas, certainly this is something widely used, and particularly here in the East or in the West, and it's pretty often a pretty good way to control harvest. But there are some situations that I can point to, for example, Pennsylvania and Minnesota, for example, two very large hunting states with 800,000 whitetail hunters in them each, where they have a one-buck bag limit. And in the case of Pennsylvania, not everybody even gets an antlerless deer. So to many hunters in Pennsylvania, it is a one-deer state. So this is a very different scenario than much of the East. And it has not restricted buck harvest to a desired level because they just simply have too many hunters still. At the end of the day, they have 800,000 hunters vying for that resource. And so even with a one-deer or one-buck in this case limit, they often still have not met their objective. There are some downsides that can limit hunter opportunity, obviously. Some hunters don't get drawn. Some hunters aren't bow hunters. Some hunters aren't certain other weapon types, so they're going to be disenfranchised with a weapon-type draw. And it often requires additional agency administration to oversee these programs as well. So here's some states with a one-buck limit currently. Four of those states being the three in the central Midwest, Kentucky, Ohio, and Indiana, and also Kansas, I would consider those one-buck states because of their intent to grow the largest antlered bucks they can. In other words, a trophy-type perspective. That's why they went with a one-buck. Minnesota and Pennsylvania did so because they have too many hunters, simply. So there's different objectives even with the same one-buck approach. And you can see they're all in the upper in the upper half of the U.S. in the east. Weapons restrictions, kind of like bag limits, can be successful, can improve buck age structure, but can also limit hunter opportunity, impact resource allocation. Some hunters, again, hunt with certain types of weapons. Some don't. Hunters often don't like them. And, again, it requires administration. Here's the states where centerfire rifles are allowed. And you can see that most of the country allows centerfire rifles either in all or part of their state, although a handful of states do not, a couple in the Midwest and a couple in the Northeast for very different reasons. But when you look at those that have restricted days of firearm opportunity, you see a very clear pattern here. These are states with 17 or fewer either muzzleloader and or rifle opportunity days, all in the upper half of the U.S. In the South, for example, our season starts, our rifle season in my home state starts in mid-October and runs through mid-January, nonstop rifle. I got 10 doe tags in my pocket and 2 buck tags in my pocket. 335,000 deer hunters get 12 deer bag limit, state of Georgia. Some states like Alabama that we finally dropped it down, it was a buck and a doe a day every day of the season for 4 months. We've now got a limit on that a little bit. So the low country of South Carolina still has no daily buck or doe limit. You can shoot as many deer every single day of the season you want. So there's a very different approaches to whitetail management. And you can see some of these states that concentrate their harvest. If you look at the first one there, this is a harvest by archery. 57% of New Jersey's entire annual harvest is taken by archery equipment. That's staggering. If you look at rifle, shotgun, not surprising. Texas, the South, where we have long liberal seasons, we expect those states. And then muzzleloader. You know, Rhode Island takes 42% of its annual harvest with muzzleloaders because they're restricted because of the high urban populations there. They don't allow centerfire rifles. So, again, just showing you some examples of what's going on out there. So what's the best way to protect these young bucks? From a biological perspective, no doubt about it, age, harvesting by age is the best. It's most precise, most flexible, once you understand how to age deer on the hoof. Again, that's a big learning curve. And that's nothing that a state agency can hope to implement. This is more of a private lands approach. So it's because it's not available to you, education really becomes the key. I'll give you two recent examples of states that chose to educate, not regulate, their way to quality deer management. Oklahoma, you can see their slogan, "Hunters in the know, let young bucks grow." There's no antler point restriction. It's simply an educational campaign. And I only had this data through 2012, but I looked at it for 13 and 14, and it's continued to improve. They've seen measurable gains in their buck age structure through education. A state that I thought in my career I would never see is New York. And this is the cover of their 2016 hunting regulation book that came out a month ago. And they have embarked upon a voluntary educational program for quality deer management in the state of New York. And it's going to be very popular, I can assure you. And they're putting some resources and some effort behind it. Antlerless deer management will shift down to the doe side of the equation. Again, we come from a different perspective in the east. Why are we harvesting these does? Obviously, to control population growth and density, to balance that sex ratio. I work with a lot of properties where we take a lot of deer. A lot of antlerless deer. My daughter there in the lower picture and I took 24 antlerless deer between us last year, just the two of us. And we help a lot of properties meet their objectives because there, in many cases, still are a large number. We have very, very high deer densities, as you can appreciate. Very different than much of your state from a whitetail perspective. Why do we take them early in the season? We get after it. We get after it early in the season. We want to reduce the harvest of those buck fawns. The difference in size is most notable early in the hunting season. So as early as we can get on our doe harvest, we do, and we stay on it. We also are trying to bank nutrition. Every single whitetail deer eats roughly 1 ton of forage per animal per year. And that's not random. They're very selective in what they take, so a ton of very high-quality forage. So the quicker we can get them off the landscape, the more the rest of the deer we're keeping have to eat and the pressure we're taking off our habitat. And you can see some stark examples. And I work with some properties that are very, very well managed, and I've worked with some that are very, very poorly managed. And we see some stark differences in habitat and also in animal quality. And these two does were taken miles apart, one under intensive quality management, one under very traditional high deer density management. And both were adult does the same size, same age, but one weighed 15 pounds or 28% more than the other, just simply due largely at least to habitat quality. So how do we take these adult does? They're the most reproductive, and again, we want to reduce those harvested button bucks. But I say all that to tell you that we are experiencing something that I have not experienced in 30 years of working with whitetails, the first decade-long declines in deer harvest and deer populations. We have seen major declines in whitetails for the first time since restocking in many states. Doesn't look too significant here, but let's take a look at the top five deer hunting states in this country, their deer harvest. This is percent change in total deer harvest over a decade. And you can see that many of these states have experienced significant declines in deer harvest.
So can I
yeah.
ask a question? As I've been listening to you, sort of wondering about threats to deer survival, and this brings up that overpopulation and mm-hmm. and lack of adequate nutrition is an important mm-hmm. factor in these areas that you're talking yes. about. That is... not so much what we see. It's heavy winters and mm-hmm. Also maybe disease. You've alluded a little bit to disease. So are there things in QDM that deal with those particular
Yeah, let me. I'm about to get to some a few things here in just a moment that might help that. If not, I'll clarify in a moment. So what's causing these things? All right, we have to look at the perfect storm, which occurred over the last decade. We've had some record outbreaks of hemorrhagic disease. In the eastern half of the U.S., 2007 and 2012 were both considered once in 50, maybe once in 100-year events. There's nothing QDM can do about that. I mean, a healthy animal may be a little more robust to mortality with EHD, but that's probably pretty sketchy. That's an endemic disease we're all going to just have to deal with. Predators and declining fawn recruitment rates. The predator populations in the eastern half of the U.S. have soared, and not just the coyote, which is a newcomer to the east, but black bear populations, bobcat populations, wolves in the upper Midwest, upper Midwest. I know some folks in northern Wisconsin that have more wolves than deer now. So we're seeing a whole myriad of macro, mesopredators that are large predators, rather, that are taking their impact on whitetail populations. And many areas, particularly if coyotes the culprit, we have the ability in many cases through trapping to mitigate those damages. If it's some of these other predators, we have almost no real way legally to make much of a difference. And I know with wolves here and some of the big predators you're dealing with here, you'd have quite a challenge to do anything with them. We had a record winter mortality event occur in the Dakotas in Minnesota. Over a 10-year period, we had almost a 10-fold degree decline in average mean winter temperature, so we saw some significant die-offs there. We were seeing a lot of acres pulled out of CRP programs when particularly over that decade. Look back, it's improving now. We saw 30% of the Midwest's CRP acres pulled out to put back into crops and biofuel production. And so we saw a significant loss of key habitat in that Midwest area in particular. And then we also were just really putting the hammer on our whitetail doe herds when all this started to happen. So many states had just completely liberalized their antlerless harvest right when all these factors came into play. So we saw a decline in harvest. So what we're seeing now, again, for the first time, if I'd have shown you this map 10 years ago, it would have all been to decrease their population. They'd all been red. You know, they would have been, we're still trying to decrease our deer herds. They're too high. Now we're seeing herds, a number of them, particularly in that sort of upper Midwest, sort of Dakota area, where they're trying to get their herds back. The hunters are screaming. They're mad. And they're below goal. They're below carrying capacity. I mean, they're low. So we're seeing some bounce back. I think the last couple of years we're seeing the harvest tick back up. I think many of these things will be self-correcting over time, but not all of them. We're in a different era. We cannot be as mad at whitetails in the East as we were for 20 years. We're going to have to be more judicious in our harvest. There's still a lot of areas like where I've showed you where I hunt, where there are a tremendous number of deer, but that's not everywhere. Again, we have to be more site-specific rather than broad-handed that we have had historically been. All right, we'll wrap it up with some habitat management. Again, there's a lot of things that can be done from a habitat management perspective. Most people, when they think of quality deer management, they immediately gravitate to food plots, but that's just one small piece or one small opportunity. I'm going to cover three. Most of the work done in from a nutritional perspective for whitetails is done to fill one of two areas. One, to increase the forb availability. Forb are these weedy plants that deer focus on, and that can be done through food plots. I mean, technically, some of the things we grow in our food plots would be considered forbs, leguminous plants. Some can be done with disking and fire. We can create natural forb communities. The other bulk is browse. One thing that is important, if you're not aware, is that unlike the mule deer, the white-tailed deer will die with a belly full of good grass. They simply do not have the digestive system capable to digesting and making a living on grass, with one exception. Young, tender cereal grains like wheat, oats, and rye, things of that nature, they can digest and do pretty well with when they're young and growing. But as a general rule, they cannot make a living on grass, and it really comprises a very small percent of their diet on an annual basis. So from a food plot perspective, there are literally millions of acres of food plots being planted in the eastern half of the U.S. Most of those are somewhere between a quarter and 5 acres in size, scattered across the landscape. What does it take to make a difference? Some research came out probably almost 20 years ago now that showed that literally as little as 1% of a landscape in high-quality production agriculture, in this case food plots, can measurably impact deer production, deer size, deer quality. So sometimes as little as 1% of the landscape is enough to make a difference, but we recommend a little higher than that. A lot of ways to manage natural vegetation. We use them all in various ways in the eastern half of the U.S., whether it be timber harvest, which would be common to you here, prescribed fire, something that, for example, my home state, I serve on the Georgia Prescribed Fire Council as well as a National Prescribed Fire Council, and we burn over 1 million acres a year for wildlife purposes in the state of Georgia. We love to burn things, and we can do it. We got better days, more often probably than you can in some cases in this country. But we also love to spray things. We love herbicides, and we use the heck out of them, and we can manipulate plant communities in a very meaningful way because we've got a tremendous number of invasives that we can control with a combination of fire and herbicide, and also disking the natural vegetation. And the reason we do this is because it's far cheaper and far more effective. I mean, the year we're having right now, I sure enjoyed flying into Seattle and seeing something green and moist. We have not had measurable rain in 14 weeks in Georgia. Every food plot we have planted is dust. I mean, not one living blade of grass for miles and miles and miles. We're in a severe drought, whereas a lot of the native stuff is holding up quite well. And so we recommend people really putting a lot of their effort in the native vegetation, or at least natural vegetation. Some of them are exotics in some cases, because they're the majority of the deer's diet. They're economical. They're, in many cases, drought tolerant, and already there and established in the seed bank if you allow them to be released. Supplemental feeding, something that is catching hold in the eastern U.S., both baiting and feeding, and we do differentiate between the two, and often rules and regulations do as well. It's a very highly controversial practice. The data is becoming fairly clear on it. Good work out of Texas has shown that if you want to crank all the feed you can to your deer herd and give it to them year-round, high-quality supplement, you'll pay for it. I mean, pay dearly. But it can get you about 15 inches of additional antler and about 15 to 20 pounds of additional body weight on a 5-year-old animal. That's about the average we're seeing out of multiple research projects, but at a tremendous cost. And I would argue that you could do that same, have that same benefit through habitat management for far less cost and a more, a far broader benefit to your habitat, not just to deer. All right, I'm going to wrap this up with just an example of some data. This was some work done at Mississippi State University that also is a recognized leader in deer research, where they looked at nutritional carrying capacity through based on natural habitat management. In other words, the number of deer days or days one deer can be supported on an acre. So if you just kind of envision putting a fence around 1 acre of habitat and putting a deer in there, how many days would it survive based on the different habitat types and treatments. So that's the fundamental basis of theirs. So they had a control, unmanaged, mixed pine hardwood stand, where one with a herbicide-only treatment, a fire-only treatment, and a fire and herbicide combination. Not surprising, the high graph there, the highest number of deer days on that 1 acre was the burn herbicide combination. And if you follow the years they came back, 99, you'll see at the bottom, you'll see some pictures there. These are years they came back with the burn. The first one is spraying, second one is a burn. Came back 3 years later, which is about the frequency we like. So even in subsequent years, we got bumps with the burn only. So, we use fire, we use herbicide, we use timber stand thinning, a lot of different practices there. We do also do what many of the folks in this state do, and that is let the farmers down the road feed your deer for you, which is obviously a source of conflict. But if you go to the Midwest, they don't plant many food plots because it's all one food plot. And they got all the soybean and alfalfa and winter wheat they can eat in some of those cases. So wrap this up. Certainly, we would not suggest that QDM is some sort of panacea that solves all ills, but it is a biologically sound and flexible management approach that improves deer herd quality, increases satisfaction for a growing number of deer hunters, and those who get engaged with this at a level, this is what's most encouraging to me. It's not the size of the deer they shoot. It's their connection with the land and the animal. It gets them more deeply, more intimately connected with the resource, and that's pretty special. Because it does establish this deeper, intimate relationship between the hunter, the hunted, and the land. And because of this, I think it provides a deeper level of satisfaction than just going out as a consumer and taking a deer and going home. If you have engagement, if you got skin in the game by managing that habitat, I think it gives you a richer hunting experience. And I think that's what's driving the support for this management approach. So with that, if I have any time for questions, I'd be happy to try to answer any that you may have.
Thank you, Brian. Fascinating. Welcome to Washington. And
thank you. I almost ended up, I could have been working for your agency when I came out of undergrad. I accepted an elk project, and I think it was Washington State University, working on the impacts of deforestation or logging and road building on the movements of Roosevelt elk. And the professor said there's only a 5% chance of the state funding won't come through. So I quit looking for projects, and guess what? The letter I got said state funding didn't come through. So I could have been in Jerry's employ at this point. Who knows?
Well, eat some good salmon before you go.
I would like to do that.
So questions, yes, Commissioner Kerbiner. Jerry, you might want to come up here, too. I guess to put this in context, having reviewed our revenue stream over the course of the years with Deputy Director Storr's guidance, and we see where the money comes from, the different constituents, be it fishing, hunting, etc., this hunting community pays the bills and is a big contributor to the state's budget, certainly this department's budget. So I guess somebody in Northeast Washington picked me with some of their frustration to ask some questions. So I'm going to ask them of both of you because I don't know which way to direct them, and I didn't write them. I'm just going to try and translate them. If the population is below objective, how would QDM respond when the buck-doe ratio and fawn recoupment ratio are both below objective? And do you get the total deer population at or above objective before you reduce doe and or work on buck doe ratios?
Well, I guess my first question to Jerry would be, are those statements fact? In other words, are those populations below current goal?
Well, it depends on how the person writing the question is defining objective. First of all, we don't have fawn to doe objective. We haven't set one of those because we think there are an awful lot of things that control fawn survival that we don't have control over. So we're typically looking at post-hunt buck to doe ratios as something that we can measure effectively. At this point on whitetail deer, especially in the Northeast, we don't have a good abundance estimate technique. We're working on one now. We're developing a new distance sampling method that we've gone through the pilot project proof of concept stage. We're now at the first year coming up this winter of an implementation stage, and so we're going to see how that works for us in terms of measuring trend. So I wouldn't say that we're not meeting our post-hunt buck ratio objectives, and we don't have a good abundance objective right now. So I guess from the QDM standpoint, in general terms, let's tell the commission a little bit about the difference between overall habitat carrying capacity and what you would consider a appropriate objective compared to that.
Sure. Obviously, there's an inherent carrying capacity of every given habitat, although it's not a fixed place on a curve. It changes seasonally, it changes annually, it changes, you know, based on a number of variables. You have to look at herd health. At the end of the day, herd health will tell you where you are on that curve. And I'm not sure the data are available right now to make that kind of a call. I don't know. I'm not sure there are age data and harvest data that would tell you. Maybe you can clear. I don't know the answer to that. But if there are data available, you would use those data to say, yes, the mean antler diameter or the average yearling body weight or the average fawn body weight is X, and that will tell you, in many cases, those younger animals are the best indicators of herd health relative to habitat quality. And so I would focus on those younger age class animals to be a barometer of where you are. If you are below goal and the goal is to increase the population, it makes sense to back off your doe harvest. Again, that's assuming that first part of my statement was correct, and I don't know that it is. But without any abundance indices, any population estimates, it's pretty hard for me to comment.
Jerry, can I just – I mean, you're saying that we don't have any really solid population estimates, but we have used surrogates such as Hunter Success and Transects and that sort of thing
We certainly do. One of our best pieces of information is our harvest data. We don't collect specific antler characteristics, but we do have overall numbers estimated and harvest of both antlered and antlerless animals. We do have antler point information for the antlered animals. We do have some rose survey work that we do in the Northeast, but that comes with all of its own baggage in terms of detectabilities and differences in detectability, a lot of variability in one day to the next on driving a route and what you might or might not see in that particular field or that particular stand. And so that's what we have right now, but we would really like to have something better, and that's why we're striving towards developing some.
I have two more questions, but I think, if I may, Commissioner Holzbeller.
Thank you. And, Jerry, did you clue Brian in what prompted this whole QDM debate? Just so he knows where we're coming from.
Brian knows some of the history, and then Brian was contacted by some of our constituents prior to coming here once the press releases went out and the agenda for the commission meeting went out. So I think he kind of has an idea of.
Okay, that's all I just want, because there again, it's really sad that Miranda can't be here today, because she was the one that filed the blue sheet on this, correct? And there again, Brian, just so you know, this all kind of came about because of pulling an antler restriction. I know myself, I voted not to pull it, because I live in the very southeastern corner of the state, and we've had antler restrictions down there forever. And just as you said in your presentation, if you were going to pull them down in our part of the world, people would be screaming to the high heavens, because we have a mixture of both mule deer and whitetail, and that was always the thing that bothered us, because in the mule deer especially, the 2 points were the year-and-a-half-old bucks, still running with the does, and, I mean, it was just a bloodletting opening morning, and that's about all anybody ever shot was little forkies. And personally, with myself, a 2-point mule deer and a 2-point with eye guard, white tail are the same age class. You know, and there again, we were shooting a few of the whitetails, but still you had some just straight horn 2 points. And like I said, I just wanted to make certain you knew where we were coming from on
I learned a lot in the last 3 days with the number of phone calls and emails that I received on this from Region 1, which it broadened my perspective. But again, it wasn't surprising. I mean, this is not surprising. We've seen this before in many, many situations. And when you pull an antler restriction after people have gotten used to it, it creates a lot of discomfort. And, you know, my question would be, what do the hunters want? You know, do you have any public attitudes data? You know, is it something they want? And if so, was the antler point restriction biologically good enough that it would be something appropriate to consider? I don't know the answers to those.
And excuse me just really quickly. And one thing, too, that kind of led was we had a really bad blue tongue. And especially in our part of the area, and I don't know. The way they talked, even in the Northeast, they had it. And so I think we kind of piled a bunch of things.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
I got two quick questions. I'll ask them together, and you guys can sort them out however you see fit. How does QDM versus spike only compare for population recovery? End of that question. Why does Washington not get included in the state's QDM comparisons?
The first one was QDM versus spike only?
Yes, and I didn't write it. I'm just reading it. How does QDM versus spike only compare for population recovery?
I'm not sure I understand what that question is getting at.
Yeah, you wouldn't harvest. Obviously, a proportion of your year-and-a-half-old bucks would be spike antlered. And if you removed only those animals, you would remove a lower number of bucks out of a population. Theoretically, you'd have a few more surviving. But That's neither here nor there. The question of why the West, in fact, isn't included in our whitetail report is that historically we have not gotten enough data from the Western states. And I think in Jerry's case it was often because the whitetail data was hard to extract from other deer that you have here. That said, I think we got Washington's data this year.
You did.
And we actually got a number of other Western states out of the blue this year, so we're actually going to have the West. And, in fact, I think we got enough Canadian provinces to finally put Canada in there. So look forward to seeing you in future reports.
Other questions? Yes.
I'm wondering if the habitat management that you talked about is beneficial, known to be beneficial to other species. Is it an umbrella species?
Yeah, we did a project also in partnership with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service about 10 years ago where we picked a dozen sites along the Appalachian Mountain Range across the eastern U.S. from North Georgia all the way to New York State. And we looked at areas of contiguous forest where we went in and created wildlife openings and planted those in this case, perennial white clover. And looked at the impacts of songbirds and small mammals, as well as deer in this case. And yes, we found benefits to a whole host of species by creating those wildlife openings. So yeah, there's pretty good data. I could refer you to a couple of different papers where good deer habitat management is good for a whole host of other species. At least that group of species that relies on early successional habitat, wildlife openings, you know, breaks in an otherwise contiguous landscape, forest landscape. Because some species don't, but I think enough do. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm just curious, trying to get my head around how the quality deer management blends in with state regulations. So if you have a state that has any buck, then quality deer management would be a personal decision of someone hunting on private land to not take the younger buck. Is that right?
That is correct.
And or if you had a state that said... a buck or a doe, for instance, then the decision for quality deer management would be personal again, and education would to be to reach those people to take the doe.
That's correct.
So, okay.
And there are so many different examples. I gave one there with Oklahoma, chose to do it through an educational process, but they have a two-buck. I think it's a two-buck state, so you still have some flexibility there. Georgia, my home state, took a hybrid approach where they have an antler restriction for one of your two bucks. And I know you don't have one, but I'm just giving you some examples. One buck is a buck of choice, and one must meet an antler restriction, for example. Other states, obviously, you can use most states you can use a buck tag on an antlerless deer, but not every state. Other states do regulate it through an antler restriction or some other method. So there's just a hodgepodge of different approaches to get to the same end game.
So then does your organization try to work with the different state agencies, the Department of Wildlife agencies, to propose what you would see as the best management. And it might differ. You know, each state might have an ingrained system of use.
That, sure.
And you say, well, we think it would be better if you did this, but they don't necessarily go that direction.
Absolutely. No, we work very closely with, of the 35 states in that eastern band that I showed you repeatedly during my presentation, I'd argue that probably 28 or 30 of those we have very good first-name relationships with the directors or the deer project leaders, where often we're the first ones they call when they're proposing a regulation. Not to say, do you support it? I mean, it's your regulation, it's your department. But just to let us know and engage us in a productive dialogue. I've served on a number of states when they're writing their 5 and 10 year deer management plans. They'll get a cross section of stakeholders, but almost always either myself or one of our biologists have a seat at the table just for input. But we're never here to suggest. I'm not here to suggest something to your agency unless I'm asked to. I mean, we're here to be partners and to give our ideas and our perspectives, but to recognize that you have to manage for a wide cross section of stakeholders. We're looking after one. And those that believe a certain way. So we recognize that we represent a significant portion and a growing number of deer hunters think like our organization thinks, I can promise you. But some don't, and we recognize that as well. And we want opportunity for everyone to have opportunity. But one thing I do, and I'll make this point and shut up, one thing that does bother me is, I've been at this a long time, 20 years ago when we would meet with certain states, and they'd say, oh, no, we can't manage QDM because we'd be managing for the minority. Okay, we'd be managing for only that small number. Now that QDM is the majority, some still say we can't manage that way because we'll be leaving the minority. Now, hang on, you can't have it both ways, you know. So fair is fair. But no, we want to be partners with agencies. That's been our MO for a long time.
Just a related question. In your work, what do you see as the number of deer hunters across the country or the East? Is static? Up, down?
We had a brief blip during the recession, and the number one variable, believe it or not, most correlated with hunter participation in this country, and it'll floor you unless you keep up with the research, is housing starts. It's inversely related to housing starts. If you look at when people are not working, many of the craftspeople are hunters, and we saw a significant measurable uptick during the recession because a lot of people were out of work, so they went hunting. When housing starts are robust, a lot of tradespeople are working 6 and 7 days a week. And this is not coming from me. It's coming from Mark Duda, Responsive Management, the top guy in this field. And I spend a lot of mic time with him at conferences around the country, so I'm intrigued by it. His take, and I share it, is that we're going to go from where we are now, somewhere around 12 million deer hunters, down to about 10 and hold that for a pretty good while. But the long term beyond that is still a little bit shaky based solely on the hunter recruitment programs out there. And there are a number of them, but they're still very, very inefficient. If you look at the resources being invested in our organization's guilty among hundreds, there's over 400 hunter recruitment programs going on right now in this country. I serve on the National Council to Advance Hunting and Shooting Sports, and it's disappointing. So we have not figured it out yet.
Yeah, that's what I'm afraid of. Because when you see the meetings that we have here, which I'm sure are characteristic of many of the states that you visit, the clientele look a lot like us.
Well, if we were Chevrolet, you know, state agencies were Chevrolet and we were Ford,
yeah.
We're looking at consumers over time, and that business model isn't near as robust as we'd like it to look.
Your buck pull of the time period reminds me of my youth in the Upper Peninsula.
Yep, you know what? That's probably that picture came from there.
I think I got a couple on that pole.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other?
Connie? It's my turn to read a couple of these.
Gary Four?
Yes. Does Washington report usable information for QDM analysis? Could you hear?
Well, I haven't seen any of the data until I heard my biologist said that we got some this year, so I can't.
Okay.
But I do recognize Jerry's challenge or the agency's challenge, because most the vast majority of states we work with have one deer species, and it's their sole driver of revenue, of everything. So they have age data, they have harvest data, they use the SAK model in many cases to reconstruct a population to get a population estimate. So some of the things we're after, you may not have at this point, but I think you're working towards some of those things. And again, the ability to parse out whitetail data specifically, so I can't fully answer that. But the data I have seen, which came from some of your 2015 reports, there is a lot of usable data in that, for sure. And I commended Jerry on that already. I thought his field staff did a good job putting those reports together. I enjoyed reading them.
Okay. My turn.
Oh.
Yes.
Gary Five.
How does QDM manage predators for maintaining stable and healthy deer populations?
In most cases, we don't, simply. Some very intensive property owners and managers would remove, in most cases, coyotes and bobcats. Those are about the only two things that we have any ability to manage in the East. And because coyotes are a non-native player in the eastern half of the U.S., our regulations are very broad and allow that. Bobcats are more restricted, and if you get into things like bears and other predators, particularly up in the upper Midwest, wolves, occasional mountain lion, we can't do anything about those. In most cases, we tell them to manage with habitat. If you provide good early successional habitat, you're going to have higher fawn survival just by having more higher quality fawning cover during those first few months of life. So predators are something we're having to learn to live with more than we're ever going to control, in our opinion.
It's all being recorded, so... And the final question is QDM an appropriate management policy for Washington State?
Sure, it's an option that would be on the table for anywhere in the country with whitetails. Absolutely. Okay. It is a management option just like a bag of tools. It can work in some areas very well. Other areas may be hampered by one or more confounding issues. If you have, you know, high deer agricultural damage, for example, and you're harvesting a lot of deer on permit, and that disrupts your buck age structure. I mean, there's certainly some areas where it may not be the best fit, but where landowners and hunters want it and it can work together, they can absolutely be successful with it.
Would you add a caveat to that in terms of private land holdings versus public lands?
To some extent, yes. Certainly, it's absolutely perfect fit for those that want it on private land. But I would also argue that providing QDM-managed state opportunities is also important. And we see that now in the eastern U.S., where in some states, anywhere from 10 to 25% of their wildlife management areas are managed under those types of, you know, either an antler restriction or some sort of approach that makes those special public lands, and the demand for them is significant. So it's not a widespread across all public lands, but certainly some wildlife management areas, private, whatever you call them in this state, public hunting areas, may lend themselves to being managed that way.
Mr. Carpenter. My last question. Brian, is this methodology that you use work? Could it work for blacktail and mule deer?
Absolutely, I used it in all the Australian deer species they had over there, and they talk funny over there. And it's just deer biology.
It was got four legs. It works, right?
If it's just managing age, managing habitat. These are simple concepts. I mean, we've almost overthought it a little bit here. You know, it's how you get there. It's what tools you use and what the public wants and what they're willing to accept and how that meets other stakeholder goals. I mean, you have all these societal things that make it difficult. The biology is very simple.
Are deer native to Australia?
No, none of them are.
Yeah.
No.
Mr. Tober.
As I was listening to you about the public versus private lands and these examples of small land plots in the upper Midwest, I was thinking, really, in our whitetail country, it's kind of public lands and a lot of suburban sprawl. So we're talking about really, I mean, my food plot
is your garden.
Is my garden, yeah. So,
well, obviously, it's more challenged in a situation like that. In a residential or ex-urban urban landscape, it's going to be more challenging than it would be in a more rural setting. Sure. But we have some co-ops in Michigan, for example. You mentioned Michigan. We got one in Michigan that stretches across two counties. It's got nearly 200 participants. Some have 5 acres and some have 300 acres. But it's really an incredibly powerful sort of message in human dimensions of how humans can work together, things that historically were very conflictual. And there's master's projects that have come out of that have shown tremendous improvements in satisfaction and all kinds of good things. Now, that wouldn't work everywhere, but where it works very, very well, and it's very powerful.
Yep. Again, the Michigan stuff, November 15th was always a school holiday.
Yep.
I don't think it still is. But
it is in Pennsylvania. It may still be in parts of Michigan. Yeah, they let everybody out because they know no one will be in school.
Yeah.
Jim? I could probably just sit down and ask these questions some other time, but could you talk about the relative differences between the effectiveness of quality deer management in arid or semi-arid habitats compared to the, you know, wet, moist and very productive habitats of the east? I'm thinking the northwest compared to the southeast. And then certainly, how would, given that we have way lower production, much lower deer densities, how would you implement quality deer management without severely impacting participation rates?
Well, I'll speak to your arid versus moist habitats. I'll use South Texas, one of the most arid places around. I used to work down there. It works fine. In fact, it started there. Quality management started one of the most arid portions of the Whitetails Range. Obviously, they cannot do with agriculture and food plots and things like that. They have to rely much more on the trough, if you will, the feeders. Although they do have some center pivot irrigation down there where they didn't back in Al's day in the 70s. So, yeah, certainly there are some differences from a habitat perspective, different habitat techniques, but it can a lot of the concepts will hold in both arid and mesic environments. The other question was low deer densities, very sort of spread out deer herds landscapes. I don't have a lot of experience out here. I don't want to overly comment where I don't have experience. I was intrigued by the fawn recruitment, or I guess it was postseason fawn to doe ratios in the 0.35 range. Does that sound reasonable? 0.4, some areas 0.5 even, half a fawn per doe.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Depending on the management zone, yeah.
Yeah, so somewhere between 0.3 and 0.5 fawns per doe postseason. That actually is something we're seeing in Georgia. We just have a higher number of females, so that's why we have so many fawns. But it used to be right at one fawn per doe. But with predation, we've seen that almost cut in half over the last 20 years, and multiple research projects to show that. So we're having similar fawn recruitment rates that you are based on the data that I can compare. Your post hunt adult buck to doe ratios are more skewed than ours would be in most of the east. You have fewer adult bucks in some areas than what I would expect in on private land. But most of our deer are privately managed. It's again very different. So that's what was the basis of the question? I've drifted there for just a minute.
Participation.
Oh, participation. Do you have barriers to participation now? And again, how many hunters do you have relative to the resource? Are there barriers today to participation? Is it an access issue? Is it a resource issue? I'd have to know more about what the existing barriers are before I could comment.
The younger people are not coming up hunting. What do we have, about 230,000 hunters? Is that right? Mm-hmm. So there's not that many hunters.
My experience, again, in the East is that the young hunters, probably because of TV and magazines, they are very ready to jump into an antler restriction or any kind of thing like that. I mean, my girls are perfect examples, and I allowed them to take any deer they wanted. They wanted to shoot a 2.5 or older out of the gate. It's just that's what they wanted. And so I don't know. I don't know the answer to your question. But if it's young hunters, I would not be overly concerned with them. After they take a
I guess that's not. I was really more talking about vulnerability, and we have some problems with just our very open habitats. Deer are very vulnerable. Antler point restrictions often end up in truncated buck populations, and not.
Did you see
don't get any much escapement?
Did you by chance, when you had that APR in Region 1, did you by chance look at participation prior, during, and post? In other words, did you see a change in participation?
Yes.
And it was negatively correlated?
Yes.
Okay. And was that a one justification the department took to remove that APR? Yes. Okay.
But speaking to that, that was a pretty short, limited period of time, wasn't it?
It's a couple of years, wasn't it?
4 years.
Four.
And on there again, we've lived with it forever, it seems like, anymore. And I mean, as far as it just becomes a way of life. And I mean, everybody, and I don't know if it's right or wrong or indifferent, but I mean, everybody wants to shoot a decent buck if you go out. And it's just one of those things. Yeah, it was just a fork horn, and you just look at them as like they were a doe. I don't see any drop or anybody, oh, I'm not going because I can't shoot a 2-point, for criminy sakes. So I think it's just one of those deals. On a short period of time, it still may be a little resentment, but with any period of time, you just get over it, and that's part of the world.
I guess one concern I've had about antler point restrictions, particularly in mule deer, is you often get one more year out of it. It's certainly not a trophy management strategy for the West. That's portrayed like that by some, but it is just flat not. And I get a little frustrated sometimes with people think, just do QDM and, oh, we'll get all these big bucks. No, you won't. You'll shoot 2.5-year-old deer instead of 1.5-year-old deer.
And I want to clarify that. You said we'll do QDM, and you're referring singularly to an antler restriction.
Yeah.
And I know that's common, and I'm not trying to be condescending or anything. That just bothers me because I hear that all the time. We tried QDM, and it didn't work, or we love QDM because it does work. And I'm like, what exactly are you talking about? Define your terms. You know, that's why we use the 4-building block approach. It's not an antler restriction. It's not doe harvest. It's not food plots. It can be a combination of all of those. But none of those in isolation are quality deer management.
Yeah, I appreciate that. But I don't know if our public understands.
Oh, I fully agree. And that's a challenge we face every day.
Yeah.
So.
Anyway, it's a bit of a frustration for us in the West that, you know, people always want everything, but
all they want is a deer under every bush, and most of them to be large antlered bucks.
That's exactly right.
I mean, that's all they want.
Yeah.
So, Commissioner Keogh, do the purse seiners have a position in that?
No, I would just ask
other than Georgia, if you wanted to go someplace to go deer hunting, quality deer hunting, what state would you go to?
Well, I'm going to be in Idaho tomorrow afternoon sitting on a mountain looking for a whitetail on public land. And you know what? I'm as excited about this particular experience of any that I've had in probably a decade, because I've spent all my time back east on some great places. But this is just such a different experience. And I miss that Western big country experience. So I'd say where I'm going to be tomorrow night is going to be about as good as I can think of right now.
Yeah. Well, our director would be happy to hear that.
Yeah.
You'll be too full from eating all of our salmon.
What I appreciate more than anything is the different cultures and traditions that make deer hunting what it is. And whether you're sitting on a mountain with somebody in Idaho, or you're sitting around a deer camp in the UP of Michigan, or you're doing a dog deer drive in the South, or whatever it may be, that we all speak the same language. It's the love of the animal. But by golly, you mess with somebody's deer, you might as well kick their dog or call their wife ugly, because there are going to be people that are upset. And this is, as you well know, in the jobs you have, probably short of, I don't know what else, there's probably something in fisheries that is close, but deer hunting is a passionate thing. And that's a good thing, because it drives your agency, drives my organization, drives passion for a lot of folks, and it feeds my family. And that's one thing I'll close on. The if you haven't got on the train of the locavore movement, please do so, because they are our largest growing segment of deer hunters in the eastern U.S. right now. And these are people who we did a locavore. We went to our locals farmers market. Our youth hunting heritage manager went to our two farmers markets in Liberal Athens, Georgia, and in two afternoons recruited 18 non-hunters that wanted to go deer hunting. And we selected eight. And we put him through a training course, and one of them took his first deer the other night, and he showed up barefooted to every hunt. He's going going with a shaman on a mountain in Colorado next month for a month to learn how to sit in snow and in his underwear and not be cold. These are some different people, and that's true story. I'm just telling you, these are very different people than what you would consider your traditional hook and bullet crowd, and they're willing to hunt, and they get it. Because it's sustainable and it's organic. And it's a real movement in our part of the world, and I suspect out here it's got to be. So
we'll have to call Mountain Rescue for folks like that.
Close.
I do notice on the back of your brochure you have a lot of pictures of youth hunting. So if you know of anything that's working in the states that you visit, maybe you could pass them on to Jerry so we can start. Because that's the more ideas that we know about, but these look like some pretty happy little campers here. So, well, I think we're for all of us. Thank you for making the trek out. Good luck tomorrow.
Thank you. And, appreciate your time very much.
Let Jerry know how you did, so you can pass it on to us.
Well, when he told me it was November, this meeting, I said I can do it. I said, but I'm going to be pretty low for a whitetail hunter. The first week of November is pretty special. And I said, if I can find something to justify me coming out here besides this, no offense to all you, I'd have done it, just not during the first week of November. So I'm glad I was able to do that. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Brian.
Thanks for again, your presentation.
Jerry, thank you for helping organize that. Okay. We have one individual signed up for open public input. We're a little bit ahead of schedule, but we'll do that. And then we're going to move upstairs into executive session, and I'll read that when we get to that point. But we have one person, Larry Buckland, and you've been before us before, so you know the rules.
Thank you. 3 minutes. Hopefully everybody's received the distribution of my comments back to the department on rule changes. I'm here to talk about rule changes. I apologize for not being here tomorrow to do that, but